Welcome to Beyond Standards, your source for authentic discussions about the world of teaching. Get ready to explore challenges, share inspiring stories, and discover strategies that will empower you to make a lasting impact on your students. Here are your hosts, who are trying to master the fine art of maintaining their sanity while managing a classroom, Joe Rohrhoff and Jeff Bologna.
Hello, fellow teachers, and welcome to episode 16 of the Beyond Standards podcast, where we dive deep into the unfiltered reality of teaching, sharing experiences and practical insights that go beyond the fancy buzzwords and acronyms that you learned at last week's PD. I'm Joe, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host and fellow middle school teacher, Jeff. Jeff, how you doing today, bud?
Joe, that was one of the best openings I've heard for the acronyms and the buzzwords that you learned at last week's PD. It kind of reminds me, I think you have some PD coming up, don't you? You're going to be out of the classroom for a little bit here, learning all the acronyms and buzzwords and all that good stuff.
I'm ready for it. I'm ready to come on with maybe a pop quiz for you on, RP, IB, MYP. I'm going to be ready for you.
I'm going to have to study up, but... I just wanted to share, with our audience about, this new experience that I've taken on this year. I'm mentoring a student teacher from the University of Michigan, who's doing a wonderful job. It's really made me kind of step back, reflect a little bit about my teaching practices. It's made me be a little more deliberate with my lesson planning to make sure it's not just kind of winging it, because I kind of have to bounce some ideas off of another colleague. But it's also, it's something 19 years into my career that I thought I would take this on. And it's been a very eye-opening but good experience. And I know, Joe, you have lots of experience, helping University of Michigan and their pre-student teaching and their interns as well. So it's been this week was our first full week together because of all the snow days that we've had. And so it's really made me, deliberately think about everything that I'm doing and not just being like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing next hour. All right, I'll figure it out, but actually really putting some thought into each lesson and why we're doing what we're doing.
Yeah, no, that's good. And, they always have their teachers coming in and observing them, their professors from U of M coming in and observing them. And I know, I have pre-interns and interns pretty regularly in my classroom, and they always kind of make you reflect, because they'll ask you questions like, oh, why did you do this? Why did you do that? And, it does make you think. And I like that challenge. I think it helps me improve as a teacher, and it sounds like it's doing the same for you.
Yeah, and we have she's got her first observation with her professor from U of M next week. So, she's starting to jump in, and it'll be interesting now. She's going to be taking over a class and then two classes. So it'll give me some more time to kind of walk into your classroom and bother you and, get your students off task.
Perfect. Yeah, I don't do much in my room anyway. I'm always happy to chat. Before we jump in, Jeff, I'll tell you, I haven't told you this yet, we are officially over 1,000 listeners. And I just wanted to take a second to say thank you. Thank you. It was a couple months ago that I told you about this podcast I'm doing and asked you if you wanted to be a part of it and, talk about teaching and talk about what we do. And I think we do a pretty good job at what we do. And I just want to say thank you for, for being there, for being through that. And if you would have told me a couple months ago you'd have 1,000 people listening, I would have said, I know that's in the grand scheme of things, compared to some other podcasts, it's not a ton, but I'm excited to be on this journey with you. So thank you.
Joe, I appreciate that. Hopefully are we getting close to Joe Rogan and the Kelsey brothers and the Manning brothers yet? Or are we still, we got to be close to those guys, right?
I think so. I don't have access to their data, but I'm sure we're right up there.
when you started the show, you said our 16th episode, and I was just thinking, holy cow, I can't believe, it's February 1st and we're on episode 16. And, today in class, we had that student walk by who was like, I was listening to your guys' podcast with my mom last night. And I was like, oh man, your life must really be so much fun. And he's like, you guys sounded great. And, I was listening to the one with Mr. Gomez about substitute teaching. I couldn't believe it. We have eighth grade student who is listening to our podcast with his mom.
Yeah. His mom is a teacher. And yeah,
we're reaching an audience though.
Yeah. So, today's going to be kind of when I first talked about this podcast, or when we first talked about it, kind of what I envisioned. And Jeff and I will be tackling three scenarios that span the spectrum of teaching experiences, from classroom management dilemmas to grading to navigating the ever-changing landscape of student use of ChatGPT, maybe for less than honest endeavors. And by the end of the episode, we hope you'll walk away with some real solutions to some real problems that I know teachers everywhere are facing these same issues. So hopefully we can bring some insight to our listeners. We got three, maybe four, we'll see how it goes, scenarios that we're going to walk through. And I love this last time we did this with Marcus Hartnett, and it went awesome, and I'm excited to go through some scenarios again.
Can't wait. That was one of my favorite episodes to take.
Ready for scenario one?
Yep, let's go.
My room has tables that sit three students and are currently arranged in groups of six. I have a handful of boys in one class that are obnoxious and constantly off task. I have other groups that work really well together and have productive conversations. They help each other. They're doing all the right things. So the question or the scenario here is, this teacher's wondering, do you break up the groups and like spread the obnoxiousness around the room? Or do you kind of clump them together and leave them in one spot together? And I know, Jeff, I think this is a scenario where we're going to differ a little bit on our opinions. I'm excited to hear what you have to say on this one.
I just want to know, did you like walk into my fourth hour recently to come up with this scenario? Because this sounds like my fourth hour, actually more like my first hour, but you know,
I think every teacher has that hour.
Yeah. Right. I read this earlier when I was prepping, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's my class. I'll see him tomorrow morning. My take on this is I think you spread them around the room. You know, if it's tables of three, you hope to put two good students and one of the obnoxious boys at a table, hoping that those good students may rub off on those obnoxious boys who are constantly off task. You know, you don't saddle those good kids with that job, but you just hope maybe some of they pick up on those the cues, like, hey, this kid's sitting here taking notes, maybe I should be sitting here taking notes. I feel like if you clump them all together, it's just gonna cause, you know, chaos. I see it at times when, you know, we do some free work time or they're working on an essay and I have a little reading area and kids, can I go sit on the couch? And so like four or five kids go sit over there and then nothing gets done. So my advice would be spread them out, break up that big group, and maybe the good kids will rub off a little bit on them. Is that what you wanted me to say?
No, I thought you were going to say the opposite. That's what I was going to say. I thought you were going to say, yeah, I kind of put them together. And, you know, if people want to make the choice of wasting their time, then allow them to make that choice. And I totally get that argument. And I think maybe at older levels, that's, you know, kids probably have a little more flexibility with their seats, that teachers may do that. But I'm right on board with you. For the kids I teach, when I have this scenario, which I do in a couple classes, I try to spread them out. I just did new seating charts today and unveil them to the kids today. And in some classes, it's like a puzzle where you have to move people around. You have to sit certain people in the front of the room and because it's on their IEP or their 504, and you can't sit this kid next to that kid. And it's a puzzle, but I try to spread this person wrote in, the obnoxiousness, spread the obnoxiousness around the room and not clump it together. Make it harder for those kids to be off task. Don't give them a scenario where it's so easy for them to be off task. And one other thing I jotted down in my notes was like for the students that are on task, I can't think of a workplace that doesn't have people in it that you're going to disagree with and maybe have a hard time getting along with. So I think that's a skill for those kids. I mean, everybody works with some idiots, right? Sometimes you have to sit next to those idiots and get along with them. It's a good skill to have, and it's a good skill to learn.
Yeah. You know, and I also try to reward some of those good kids by, you know, maybe putting someone who I know they're close with or someone that they've worked with in group projects prior. Maybe I sit them together then with one of the obnoxious ones. That's what I would probably do. I might pull a couple of them aside and say, hey, listen, I know so-and-so can get off task. Hopefully it doesn't bother you guys too much. Appreciate it. You know, kind of pat them on the back, yeah, at the front end of it. And maybe they'll, you know, they won't complain too much about it. But you know, this year, Joe, has been the first time I've ever really struggled with seating charts, because you brought up seating charts. You know, I have my first hour, I have 34 seats and I have 33 students. And so there's nowhere to put some of these kids, right? You can't put someone at a table by themselves. So this year has been the first year where I've just like struggled.
Yeah, with class sizes up and we have a pretty challenging group this year, just with, you know, classes with a lot of kids that really want to sit next to each other and talk to each other and easily get off task. It's a challenge in my room as well.
So my advice to this teacher, spread them out, spread out the wealth.
Yeah, spread the love, baby. Spread the love. All right, we ready for the next one?
Yeah, this one I've got a lot to talk about.
Sweet. Let's jump into this one. I recently found out that some of the teachers at my school give kids 50% if they do not turn in the assignment or if they get everything wrong. So basically, you start at 50%. I'm wondering how this is fair to the kids who actually earn a 50%, or really to any of the kids. I give true grades, but let students have one redo within a few days. I just want some feedback on the situation, please. Go ahead, Jeff. Tell us how you feel. Tell us how you really feel.
Oh, man, how do I really feel? If you don't turn the work in, you don't get any credit for it. Plain and simple. Because that's not how the real world works. You know, in the real world, if we don't do what we're supposed to do, we're not going to get, credit for doing nothing. If a student doesn't do the work, that's their job. I mean, that's their choice. They're making that choice to not do the work. For example, I just had some end of the quarter presentations and I had two students who I gave them multiple chances. I gave them extensions and two of them just chose to say, yeah, I'm not going to do it. I said, okay. I mean, I put a comment in the grade book that says they're making that choice and I put a zero. I'm not going to give them 20 out of 40 for not doing anything.
You're punishing everyone by doing that.
Right. And I actually talked to my wife, who's also a teacher, about this, and she agrees with me. What about, let's say it's a math test. What about the kid who got 20 out of 50 but tried their hardest, and the kid who doesn't even do anything gets 25 out of 50, right? Or do you start right at 50%? I mean, it seems like you're rewarding kids for being lazy. You're rewarding kids for not doing anything. And then they're not really learning the skill.
I agree with everything you said. I think most teachers out there would agree with that. A kid doesn't deserve a grade that they didn't earn. Like grades, you're supposed to, just like you earn a paycheck, you should earn your grades. And, you know, my opinion on grades, I mean, I teach middle school. I think grades are an overrated thing in our district. Kids and parents both are way too concerned about their grades to begin with. But at the same time, kids need to learn that you can't just get 50% of anything for doing nothing. You know, you can't just do nothing and get half a paycheck. You can't do nothing and, you know, succeed. And I can't think of a sport where you could, you know, succeed to any level by doing nothing. You're teaching a kid that doing nothing gives them something, and that's just not right.
And you know, Joe, I understand the philosophy behind it, right? If you have a, you know, 100-point essay and a kid doesn't do it, and so they get 0 out of 100, the chances of that kid not passing the class is highly, highly likely, right? So I understand the philosophy behind it, but I don't think it's not real life, right? And I also, in this scenario here, whoever posted this said that they allow, you know, one redo within a few days. I also have some questions about that as well, because, you know, in my class, we're working on an essay right now. The kids have had all week to have me look at it, have my student teacher look at it. And then when I grade it, all they're redoing is making the comments that I you know, if I circled a word and said it's spelled wrong, they're just changing it. And then they're going to resubmit it. So I don't know. I have some issues with redos as well, but the 50% thing I think is just bonkers.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the 50% thing, I don't know the origin or where it comes from, but I feel like more and more there are districts that are just trying to find ways to pass kids. And this is a justification to allow to push these kids through the system. And we're not really helping them. We're pushing kids through the system, but they're not learning anything. We're not teaching them. Not only are we not teaching them the content, we're also not teaching them accountability. And I think we have to find ways to, you know, we're moving kids up to the next level without them knowing the material. And we have to step back and say, is this what is best for the kids? What can we do to help these kids? And the last note I put down on this one is, well, I don't agree with this policy. And I agree basically, Jeff, with everything that you said. I'm not a fan of like uniform grading systems. I'm not a fan of the district saying every teacher has to grade this way. Like, I think different teachers should have the flexibility to grade the way that they think is best for their students. So while you might not agree with your colleague's grading system, don't let their grading system bother you, and don't let it affect your grading system. Don't let it affect what you think is best for your kids in your class, because that policy might work for some teachers, but it wouldn't work for me. So I am in favor of allowing flexibility. Different teachers, you know, weigh homework, for example, might be worth a little bit in one class and a lot in another. Might work different for different subject areas and different teachers, which I love. But don't let other people's policies really bother you.
Yeah, and we actually talked about it last week when we talked about cell phones. And, you know, even our guest Brady Couture said how, you know, different classes had different rules for their cell phones. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And, you know, what you brought up, Joe, reminds me of the days of common assessments. Remember when we all had to have a common assessment? And it's like, well, my colleague taught the same book, but she focused on this character and this conflict, and I focused on this. How can we have a common assessment? So, you know, just because your neighbor teacher gives 50% for zeros, that doesn't mean you do. I mean, it's your classroom. You know, I'm a firm believer, like you said, too. Hey, this is my classroom. I don't care what Mr. Smith is doing over there in my room. This is my policy. You know, I think you can. It would just be like if we went and taught in a different building and we'd have to follow the policies of that building, right? Or that principal.
Right. All right. Any other comments on the grading one before we move on to number three?
No, but this isn't enjoyable because we're agreeing on both of them. We're not like bantering at all. Like, come on.
All right, we'll see if we can disagree on this one. While reviewing a recent assignment from a specific student, I noticed a considerable improvement in their writing, and it's obviously not their work. This raises suspicions of potential AI use. When I approach the student about it, they strongly deny any involvement with AI. Despite my familiarity with their writing, there's no concrete evidence to support the suspicion. As a teacher, how do I navigate this situation, especially when faced with a student's denial and the absence of definitive proof of AI use? I have a feeling we're going to agree on this one too, but hopefully we have some insight that'll help some other teachers. What are your thoughts on this, ELA teacher?
Oh, man. Yeah, this one's right up my alley. I hope Miss Sandija is listening to this episode, because her and I deal with this regularly. I love the student vehemently denies this, and I've had this conversation hundreds of times with students. What? I didn't know that. No. My suggestion to the teacher would be, you know, you have to grade it as is right now. I mean, unless you have definitive proof, you can't give them a zero. You could have that conversation, and I've had to have the conversations with students where you just talk about, you know what, I don't trust you right now. I don't trust your work. You know, what I have gone to, right, you know, I just started it with this assignment, was I'm not having them doing a rough draft on their own document that they open up. The document that they open up and do their rough draft on is the document that I have access to, my student teacher has access to. And so if there's any questions of AI production, I've got their outlines. If it doesn't look anything like their outline, I also have, I just check the revision histories, and I'm like, oh, all of a sudden they have an entire paragraph written at 1204, and at 1201, they'd had nothing. Right there is your definitive proof. You know, so I've started that, because before I just had them opening a Google Doc and then they would paste it into my assignment sheet. And I realized, you know, I need to be better about that, especially with, you know, the advancements of AI. I think for the next writing assignment, you tell this, you know, that student or all your students, we're going to do it all in class. No working on it at home. No working on it outside of class. You know, and you may have to check each draft at the end of the hour to see where they're at. So you can catch them if they are doing stuff at home. Obviously for this one, you just kind of have to let it slide, but you have to have that hard conversation with the kid. I probably wouldn't contact a parent yet. Because then you get into the, you're accusing my child of being a cheater.
Right.
I would wait until there's definitive proof. How does like social studies, where you guys don't do a ton of writing, how do you handle situations like this?
Yeah, it's hard because I agree 100% with what you said, that if you don't have definitive proof, then you can't, you know, give the kid a zero, or, you know, I think it's you can't accuse the kid of cheating, but I would definitely have a conversation with the kid. And this is one of those scenarios where, like, you might not have definitive proof, but teachers know. It's like when that kid is sitting in the back of the room with his shoulders slouched and his eyes looking down, and you know he's on his phone, and he'll say, "What? I didn't." Like, teachers know. Teachers know what you're doing. Like, we know if when you look at your writing that it's not your writing. And the best thing you can do is try to catch it early and catch a student and, you know, warn them as they're working. Like, we're working on a project now where a lot of the kids are doing a writing portion to that project, and I'll just remind them, "Hey, guys, I found a few students last hour that used AI, and I just want to warn you that that's not okay for this assignment." And then as I go through and kind of check in with each group, "Did you write this?" Like, or I'll just tell them, "Hey, I know this is not your writing," or you'll look at it and you'll say, "Hey, can you explain that word to me? I hope this isn't what you're going to turn in, because I know this isn't your writing." So, like, if you can catch them early in the process before they submit it, then hopefully they're learning a lesson right there, and hopefully they will clean it up and know that, you know, teachers are there, teachers are kind of onto them and catching what they're doing, because AI is getting so good right now. But the AI detectors, when Justin Bruno was on and he was talking about AI, and one of the things that came up is AI detectors, and they are not 100%. They're never 100% accurate. And so you can't just say, "Oh, I put it in the AI detector." And I know Justin suggested it's okay to use them as kind of a starting point to a conversation, but it's not a way to know definitively if a student is cheating. So I agree that, you know, there's got to be alternative ways. As teachers, we have to look for alternative ways to assess kids, and whether that be doing more with paper and pencil. Like in my class, and, you know, I teach American history, it's easy to, "Hey, pull out your pencil and write a quick, you know, whatever. Do you think that Andrew Jackson deserves to be on the $20 bill? Well, we've been talking about Andrew Jackson. You should be able to come up with 3 or 4 reasons why he should or should not be on the $20 bill. And you should be able to do that on your own." So I agree, bringing it in the classroom, pulling it off computers, or just kind of making yourself aware of some of the tools out there to help you determine if a student is not doing his own work.
And Joe, let me, if I could add, that actually reminds me, I got 2 things, but the first one is that reminded me, I actually had a conversation Monday morning with one of the 7th grade ELA teachers in our building, and she made the same comment you did about, "I may go back to having them write things on paper with pencil in my room, because, you know, it's just getting out of control with how much plagiarism and AI usage is going on." My second point, you know, for this teacher would be, if you have, like, all of our assignments are done through Google, and I have access to students' essays from 3 years ago when we first started using Schoology. I can go all the way back and find them. So if you did an assignment, say, in the first semester that was a big writing piece, pull it up. You could show the kid, "Hey, this was first semester. This is this one. Yeah, they don't mesh." If you're looking for definitive proof, that can be your definitive proof. That could be your key to, "Hey, this, you know, this is what you did in quarter 1. Now we're in quarter 3, and this is what you're doing. They don't match. They don't match." And that could be a conversation then you could send home to parents, like, "I'm just having some concerns," right? The way you word it, you know, "I'm having some concerns. I noticed that this assignment was way different than the one we did in quarter 1. So go back in your files and try to find those old assignments. It's easier now with everything on the computer than it was 5, 6 years ago when they were turning essays in by, on paper.
Right. No, I agree with that. And the last thing, and this ties in with that, yes, you know, contact the parents once you have the proof and communicate with the kid. My advice for teachers would be, though, don't make this the hill you die on. I know there have been teachers that I've, you know, worked with in the past that kind of the same scenario, you know, a student is cheating, and they'll, you know, go contact the parents fight back, and they, you know, take it to the next level, the district, and it's all over a grade in middle school. And I don't know. I think choose your battles. If this is the battle you want to fight, then great. But for me, this would not be the hill that I die on.
And as a parent, I would rather my child learn this lesson in middle school than in high school or in college, you know, right? You know, if they're going to get caught, I'd rather it be caught now than when they're a junior or senior in high school. And then all of a sudden they, when they go to apply to the University of Michigan, they got to check that box where you ever caught cheating on an assignment or something. You know, you don't want yep. that.
Right.
And that's the teachable moment that you have with these kids, right? That, and that's where those relationship pieces come in, where you can have that teachable moment.
Yeah. All right, Jeff, well, that's going to wrap it up for that. Any other thoughts on that scenario?
No, Joe, I thought all three scenarios that we brought up tonight all are really good ones, and ones that I, as a middle school teacher, we're facing on a daily basis. And I know high school teachers, and I'm pretty sure elementary school teachers are facing the same situation. So hopefully our listeners, if they're listening to this and they say, oh my gosh, that reminds me of my day or my classroom, hopefully we offered a little insight onto how we would handle these situations. This was fun.
Yeah, that was awesome. That'll wrap it up for this episode. But to build on what Jeff said, if you found some valuable information, please share it with your colleagues. Let your colleagues know. Last week I mentioned that, hey, we had a lot more reviews on Spotify than on Apple. We got two more 5-star reviews on Apple this week. We'd love to get two more this upcoming week. So please, guys, when you guys review the podcast, not only does it kind of help us feel good about what we're doing, but it helps spread the word. It helps get our voice out there to more people, which is what we're really trying to do. All right. Join us next week as we shift our focus outside the classroom to an often overlooked topic, and that is teacher self-care. We'll be diving into strategies to prioritize your well-being as a person and not just as a teacher. It's an episode I think that will improve your life both inside and outside the classroom. This is Joe and Jeff signing off, reminding you to keep going above and beyond those standards, because you may not make a lot of money, but you do make a difference.